Okay, we are in 2 Kings chapter 14. Would have liked to have our timeline up there, but the computer is against me today. It thinks it has done enough work, and it's deciding to quit. We can draw it on there? Yeah, you would draw on the screen with a Sharpie? Mm-hmm. No, probably not a good idea. So, at any rate, we have the kings. Let's try to set our stage of kings here. We have had Joash ruling in the southern kingdom. He's the boy who started ruling when he was 7 years old, took over after Athaliah. And in the north, we have another man by the name of Jehoash, or sometimes Joash, ruling. And he comes on the throne after the Joash in the south, but if they have a slight time, just a couple of years of overlap there. Well, the king of the north, Joash, is the king when Elisha dies. And that's what we read about in the end of chapter 13. When Elisha calls him to him, just before Elisha dies, and he tells him to take his bow and shoot it out the window as an illustration that God is going to use Joash, the king of the north, to defeat the Syrians who have been invading from the north side of Israel. And he asks them then to take arrows and shoot the ground. And Joash shoots how many times? Three times. And Elisha says what? Why'd you stop? You should have shot four or five times, and then you'd have completely defeated the Syrians. But as it is, you are going to only defeat them three times. Here's what's fun about that scenario. Do our actions impact the course of history? Sure they do. Does our obedience or lack of obedience to the Lord impact the events of history? Does prayer change things? Yes, absolutely, we believe prayer changes things. But does God have a plan for history? So how does that all work together? This is stuff that'll tie your brain in knots, trying to figure out, how is it that God has a plan of history that goes from the very beginning to the very end, and yet things like this where he says, well, you would have done this, but now you're not going to because you didn't respond faithfully. Eldon. Mm-hmm. But we'll never know, will we? No. But God does know. Here's one of the instances that we can show that God knows not only what actually will happen, but God also knows what could have happened. So take just the few events of your day and think about all of the changes that could introduce into the day, the different possibilities that your decisions have. So could it change the day based on what you have for breakfast? It might. You know, you eat the wrong food. What if you all just got up and had Pop-Tarts and a bowl of Cocoa Krispies? Right. Would that have ramifications for your day? The kids say, yes, we would love our day. And the rest of us say, oh, wow, I don't know that I would even survive that that event, right? Eldon? You'd be hungry by 9:30, exactly. So that would change the day, right? So that just that one little decision can have impact on what happens the rest of the day. And now multiply that by all the different decisions that you make throughout a day and that everybody else makes throughout the day. And you start to get the boggling idea of how many things God can keep track of in his mind. That if he knows all of those possible outcomes and scenarios and where this thread would have gone, but it didn't go there, that's the God we serve. And yet he can also pick out the one thread that will be because he's planned it. And he's established it and says, this is what will happen. So, did God know that Joash was going to only strike the ground three times? Yep. Was that part of God's eternal plan? Yep, already was. So how could it have been different? If that was God's eternal plan, how could it have been any different? Couldn't have. But Elisha says, you could have defeated Syria completely, but you didn't. Now you're not going to. But Elisha's a person too? Mm-hmm. So this is Elisha's misreading of things. You'll ask, that's right. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. But God knew that it was going to be three, so.
Right.
So he just planned the future by what he knew.
Oh, did he plan the future by what he knew was going to happen, or did it happen that way because that was his plan?
Well, yeah.
Eldon. There are. Yes, there are. It is amazing how many different little threads could wind up that way. But this is what theologians love to debate about. So the big question that you get into when you talk about God's sovereignty is, if God has established an eternal plan for the history of the world from beginning to end that includes every little decision that we've ever made, could things have been different? And if they cannot be different, then what difference does it make, our decisions that we make? Because it's going to come out the way God wants it to, right? Right. If God has an eternal plan, is that plan going to happen?
Yes.
So what difference does it make that I do what I'm supposed to do? His plan's going to be accomplished, right?
He wants our obedience.
He wants our obedience? Mm-hmm. But why? He's going to accomplish his plan anyway. Oh, okay. So he's planned on blessing us in that as well. Mm-hmm. Eldon? It depends on your tread, right? Whether or not you still have those studs on your tires that you were hanging on to. Well, those are fun things to contemplate. And like I said, if you let yourself, you can get all tied up in knots about how that all works out. Ultimately, part of the answer is, we're not God, and we can't figure that all out. And aren't you glad God is not completely understandable? He is God incomprehensible. He's worth, and he's not dependent on us. Exactly, right. So God does have a plan for the history of the world. He is accomplishing that plan. His purposes will be established, and yet he does include us. And somehow that all works together. And maybe when we get to glory, we'll understand it all completely. But until then, we are struggling with our limited intellects and our limited understanding of how this all works. So, that event led to the partial defeat of Hazael, the king of Syria, by Israel. Israel beat him back and regained some of the land that Syria had conquered from Israel. So I have to use our pull-down imaginary map here. And if you look right here, you can see the Sea of Galilee in the north of Israel. And this area here is the hills of Ephraim. And the Jezreel Valley goes just south of the Sea of Galilee there. Of course, Judah's down here in the south and Ephraim here. Syria is kind of a larger country, just a bit up north. And they have kept coming down over the past couple of generations, and they've been whittling away at Israel's territory. So they've conquered all of this area of Ramoth-Gilead on the east side of the Jordan River. They've conquered down the side where the Philistines live along the coast of the Mediterranean, and Ephraim was sandwiched there in the middle. And so when God uses Joash to beat Syria back in these three major victories, he's able to win back some of the Jezreel Valley and some of the Philistine coast over there. He doesn't get back anything over here in Ramoth-Gilead. That's going to come later. So we pick up in chapter 14, verse 1. We've read the end of Joash's kingdom in the north, and now we pick up in the south again. In the second year of Joash, the son of Jehoahaz, king of Israel, Amaziah, the son of Joash, king of Judah, began to reign. He was 25 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 29 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Jehoadan of Jerusalem. And he did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, yet not like David his father. He did all things as Joash his father had done. So what did Joash do? What was Joash's reign like? Good until the end, and then what did he do? He killed the priest's son who was prophesying against him, right? And he started to slip off of his faithfulness in the end there. So, when it tells us that Amaziah is doing like his father Joash, we're going to see that same pattern. He's faithful most of his rule, but then toward the end, he's going to taper off and lose his faithfulness. Isn't it an interesting thing that Paul compares the Christian life to a race? Because how many of you have ever run a long, long race? No? You're all sane people, that's why. I knew there was a reason I liked you guys. But that is our lives. We know that life is short. We know that our days are like a vapor, but at the same time, they can be wearying. Life can get you down. Life can wear you out. And sometimes we just want to sit back on our haunches and relax and watch and not be at the ready, spiritually speaking. And a lot of people, that happens toward the end of their days. They start off excited, and as time goes on, they just start to wear down. And all these kings, both Joash and Amaziah and even Uzziah, his son, are going to be illustrations to us of what happens when you let your guard down. Now, there's going to be a specific thing that makes Amaziah kind of falter at the end, and we'll see what that is as we go through here. Verse 4, the high places were not removed. The people still sacrificed and made offerings on the high places. That's been a perennial problem in the southern kingdom of Judah. As soon as the royal power was firmly in his hand, he struck down his servants who had struck down the king, his father. If you remember, Joash was... A coup was raised against Joash in Judah, and he was assassinated. So now his son Amaziah is taking care of that problem and executing the assassins. But he did not put to death the children of the murderers, according to what is written in the book of the law of Moses, where the Lord commanded, fathers shall not be put to death because of their children, nor children be put to death because of their fathers, but each one shall die for his own sin. Why is that a remarkable statement? Okay, we're not responsible for other people. Right, okay, I'm sorry. Why is it remarkable that Amaziah follows this command?
Because the people have been turning away from the commandments.
Okay, because, yeah, faithfulness to the commandments wasn't really the norm. What was the norm in the Eastern world when a new king came to power? Kill off any challengers, right. Anybody you perceive as a threat. The ancient kings were exceptionally paranoid people. And so why would the sons of these assassins be considered a threat? Because they might try it too. And especially if you execute dad, what is son going to try to do? Revenge. So, and a lot of times in the ancient world, if you executed dad, you executed all the sons too, just to make sure there are no family members left to try to take vengeance. Eldon? Oh, right. Haman is an Agagite. Yeah, an Agite. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep.
This is a case where if they were to kill the queen, they would have eliminated him.
Talk about a family grudge. It lasted 800 years. Mm-hmm. I won't ask if anybody has any family grudges lasting that long. We don't like those people because of, I don't even know why anymore. All right, so this is remarkable that he's obeying this law, and he probably got some political flack for this because people would say, hey, you need to take care of that whole family or they're going to wind up rising against you. And his answer was, no, God commanded us not to do that. And just face it frankly, folks, we know that obeying God's command makes us countercultural people. We are going to be standing against what the rest of the world thinks is the right thing to do and thinks is the best way to handle things. But we know that God's ways are true. It's one of the biggest parts of acknowledging God in all your ways that Proverbs 3, 5, and 6 talks about. In all your ways, acknowledge Him. Doing what He says regardless of what everybody else thinks about it. And so at the beginning here, Amaziah shows himself to be a man of courage, a man of character. Verse 7, he struck down 10,000 Edomites in the Valley of Salt, took Selah by storm, and called it Jokthiel, which is its name to this day. So this little event here between verses 6 and 7 are actually about 15 years of time. Amaziah is on the throne for quite a while before he goes down and engages in a battle, a series of battles, really, against Edom. Now, when David was king, Edom was subjected to Israel, and they paid tribute. But a couple of generations before this, Edom was able to secure their own independence again, and so Amaziah is going back there to restore this. So back at our map again, if you remember the Sea of Galilee here, and Ephraim's here, and Judah down here in the south, bordered by the Dead Sea on its eastern border, Edom is down here, just to the southeast of the Dead Sea. That's where the people of Esau lived. So verse 7 summarizes this battle. He strikes down 10,000 Edomites in the Valley of Salt. That phrase actually is spoken of by several different kings. And so it seems to be the place just on the southern tip of the Dead Sea was a marshland where they would engage in battle. And it's called the Valley of Salt because there's a lot of salt down there. Big business harvesting salt off the sea, the Dead Sea these days too, even these days, just like it was then. And so he goes down there, engages in a battle, and he kills 10,000 Edomites. That's a pretty big loss to sustain, and it effectively subdues Edom. But I want to turn to Chronicles. If I lean into that microphone too far, it really gets loud. We're going to turn to 2 Chronicles chapter 25, parallel passage. Gives us a little more detail about Amaziah and his rule. The first few verses give us pretty much verbatim the same thing that we've already read about not executing the sons of the assassins of his dad. But verse 5 is where we want to pick up, and we get a little more detail about this battle into the Edomites. It says, "Then Amaziah assembled the men of Judah and set them by fathers' houses under commanders of thousands and of hundreds for all Judah and Benjamin. He mustered those 20 years old and upward." That, again, was the Mosaic regulation for warriors, 20 years old and up. And so, again, he's obeying what God told him to do. "And he found that they were 300,000 choice men, fit for war, able to handle spear and shield." That's a pretty significantly sized army. Do you remember how many people Joash's dad had left to him when he died after the Syrians invaded? He had 10,000 and a few chariots. So here's the king of the southern kingdom, and we're only about 15 years later, and he's already got 300,000 soldiers. So he's got a sizable army at his command. Look what he does next, though. Here's where things start to take a bad turn. Verse 6, "He hired also 100,000 mighty men of valor from Israel, the northern kingdom, for 100 talents of silver. But a man of God came to him and said, 'O king, do not let the army of Israel go with you, for the Lord is not with Israel, with all these Ephraimites.'" Ouch. Okay. How long has God been against Israel? Yeah, from the beginning, because they keep enshrining these golden calves as their gods instead of turning to the one true God. And so a prophet comes and tells King Amaziah, "Don't bring these 100,000 guys with you. God will not help you in the battle if you bring these guys along." What would be your thought? Obey, just don't bring them along. Okay. All right, you've already got a huge army. That's a good point. What else might you be thinking about? Okay, just going to ignore God because I'll have a huge army. Eldon? You are. Mm-hmm. But there is pressure to not obey, isn't there? So what kind of pressure do you think he's going to face? What did he just give these 100,000 men? He just gave them a huge amount of money. 100 talents of silver. What about that? I don't think they're going to give it all back. Probably not. So his thought is, and this is what he says next, the man of God. Oh, sorry, verse 8. You go, act, be strong for the battle. Why should you suppose that God will cast you down before the enemy? For God has power to help or to cast down. And Amaziah said to the man of God, but what shall we do about the 100 talents that I have given to the army of Israel? I love God's answer here. Look at what he says. Because don't we get worried about this stuff sometimes? Well, what about that money? What about that thing? What about that stuff? I'll lose it all. And the man of God answered, the Lord is able to give you much more than this. Boy, if we could just latch on to that thought and hang on to it all the time, wouldn't that be great? The Lord is able to give you much more than this. You know what? If you obey me, isn't God able to replace 100 talents of silver? I mean, that seems like a big thing to us, but how big of a thing is it for God to replace that wealth? It's nothing. It's nothing. Now, once again, we can't rely on saying, well, God absolutely will give you the money back, but he can take care of you still. He can undo the effects of your previous decision. So when you find yourself having made a bad decision, what do? Ask forgiveness, right? You repent. You turn. You turn around and start walking the other way and leave it all behind. And sometimes that does mean leaving some stuff behind. But that little statement, probably the very, very simple statement, but not an easy one to follow. Isn't the Lord able to give you much more than this? Yeah, out of his abundance. Now, what else was Amaziah worried about in hiring these guys? We read a little bit of it there, and the man of God sort of had to rebuke him for it. Verse 8, he tells him, you act, be strong for the battle. Why should you suppose that God will cast you down before the enemy? So why did he initially hire these men? He was worried that 300,000 Judean men wasn't enough. Do we ever worry that what God has given us isn't enough? Yeah, we do. But all of the answers to those questions are right in the answer that the prophet gives to him. God's able. Why do you suppose God's going to cast you down before the enemy? Because does the number of troops matter? In a battle where God is fighting, does the number of troops matter? Does the amount of money matter? Isn't God able to supply all of these things? Absolutely he is. And it's such a simple lesson, but it's such a hard one for us to actually live out. Because we all get worried about money. We all get worried about finances. We all get worried about supply. We all get worried about whether or not we'll have enough. Whether it's enough money for, you know, health expenses or the new car we need or the clothes we need or the food we need or whatever it is. We all have those moments where it ties us up in knots. And God is just sitting up in heaven waiting patiently for us to realize the truth that he's got this. He's got it all taken care of and he's just waiting for us to trust him again. Well, what do we do about the 100,000 talents that I've given the army? Man of God answered, the Lord's able to give you much more than this. To his credit, verse 10, then Amaziah discharged the army that had come to him from Ephraim to go home again. How do you think they're going to respond? Okay. Hey, we just made 100 talents of silver for nothing. Fantastic. You feel like they're not going to be okay with this decision, okay? Well, what else are they facing by being dismissed? I mean, it's not just like they get to go home and get paid for nothing. Sounds like they got fired. Would you be happy about being fired? No? Now, what happens if you hear about why you got fired? Why did they get fired? Because God doesn't like you. Right? God's not on your side. All right. How would you feel about that as an Israelite? You might be upset because think about this perspective from those northern people. Do they worship God? Not in reality. Do they think they do? We worship Jehovah just like we do. We got the altar to him in Bethel. We got another one up in Dan. What makes you think we're not true Israelites, that we don't worship Jehovah? You know, the Samaritan woman had this same problem a few hundred years later. And she says, You Jews think that Jerusalem's the only place that we should worship. But we worship here on this mountain. We don't have that trouble today at all, do we, where people think, well, yeah, I'm a Christian. Are you? Oh, yeah, but, you know, I believe there's other ways, too. I think you can be genuinely righteous, you know, as a whatever, fill in the blank. See, doesn't that call into question your view of what it is Jesus did and why you need him? You know, Christianity is purposefully an exclusive thing. It's not Jesus and. It's Jesus. That's it. And anybody trying to walk the fence is deluding themselves one way or another. Well, so these Israelites are going to be upset, number one, because God's not with them, and they're going to be thinking to themselves, now hang on a second. That's a rude thing to say. We're Israelites too. God brought us out of Egypt just like he did you. But they're not going to connect this, that God is not on your side because you've been walking in rebellion against him for 150 years. Another thing that they might be upset about, what happens after the battle to the victor?
A lot of money,
right? So they're not just thinking about the 100 talents of silver they were just paid. They're also thinking spoils of war. The survivors get fabulously wealthy in ancient battles. So you pick up other swords, you pick up clothing that hasn't been stabbed through too many times, and you take it home and you wind up with a lot more wealth than you went to battle with. So they're thinking of the loss here of the prestige from being fired, the insult of saying you're not God's people, and the loss of the financial gain from the end of battle. So we are told they go home very angry with Judah, and they returned home in fierce anger. But Amaziah took courage and led out his people, I'm in verse 11 now, and went to the Valley of Salt and struck down 10,000 men of Seir, that's Edom. So now we've caught back up with the book of 2 Kings, but we have a little more detail. Verse 12, the men of Judah captured another 10,000 alive. Now, if you're a little weaker constitution, you might not want to read this next part, okay? They captured another 10,000 alive, took them to the top of a rock, and threw them down from the top of the rock, and they were all dashed to pieces. Okay. Well, all right, let's bring some perspective to this. Why in the world do you do this?
You want more spoils.
So as they're jumping off the cliff, you're taking everything off of them? I don't know. I think you'd want to get it before you throw the person off the cliff. No, the Amalekites, they were supposed to completely destroy, yes. Mm-hmm. Why would you do this? This seems barbaric and cruel to us in 21st century. Okay, sure, yeah. It certainly decimates their ability to make war, doesn't it? You just killed 10,000 of their soldiers, and now you're going to throw another 10,000 over the cliff. What else does this do for the Edomites? Not just taking away their men, their fighting men. What else is it going to do? It will cripple the families, yep.
Shame?
Partly shame at being defeated in battle, yep. But when your captor, your defeater, treats you this way, what does it do?
Shows
that they're stronger. Puts a fear in the defeated, doesn't it? You rise up against us again and we'll do worse next time. And so he does this. He throws these 10,000 men over the edge of the cliff. They're all dashed to pieces. Verse 13. But the men of the army whom Amaziah sent back, not letting them go with him to battle, that's the Israelites that he dismissed, they raided the cities of Judah from Samaria to Beth Horon and struck down 3,000 people in them and took much spoil. So they are so aggravated that they don't get to go along to this battle and reap the spoils of war, that while Amaziah and his armies are gone, they invade Judah, they kill a lot of people, and they take off spoils of war, whatever they want. So they figure they're going to get back whatever they want to get back anyway. That's going to create a problem, right? Mm-hmm, certainly will. So, verse 14, we're still filling in some of the details that 2 Kings didn't give us about the reign of Amaziah. Because Well, we're still between verses 7 and 8 of 2 Kings 14, so we're going to keep reading here. Verse 14, after Amaziah came from striking down the Edomites, he brought the gods of the men of Seir and set them up as his gods and worshipped them, making offerings to them. That would be the failure, right? Now, let's just think through the logic of this, shall we? In the ancient world, the gods played out their little goings-on in the world of men. And so the ancient people really saw that the happenings of kingdoms and nations was the happenings, was a display of the strength of their gods. So, if you lost in battle, what did that mean about your god? He was weaker. So here Amaziah goes down to Edom. He brutally defeats the Edomites, but then he takes their gods home and starts worshiping him. What is the sense in this? Didn't you just prove that the god of Edom is not as strong as the god of Israel? What throws all that kind of sensibility on its head, though? You know, it's the sinful heart of man. Does the sinful heart of man ever make sense? Does it have to follow the rules of logic and sensibility? Certainly not. When it comes to our sin, there is no figuring it out. It's why Jeremiah says the heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? Who understands it? Who understands their own heart, much less the hearts of other people? So why would he come along and do this thing? Because he was led astray and deceived by his own sinful heart. John Calvin wrote, "My heart is an idol factory. It's just constantly trying to pump out new idols, and I have to always be on guard against it." And here Amaziah falls prey to his own heart's desire to worship something other than God. And he finds it in the idols of Edom, even though he just defeated them. So God is not going to take this without saying something. So verse 15, "Therefore the Lord was angry with Amaziah and sent to him a prophet who said to him, 'Why have you sought the gods of a people who did not deliver their own people from your hand?'" That's exactly what we were saying. Why would you worship the God who just got defeated? "But as he was speaking, the king said to him, 'Have we made you a royal counselor? Stop. Why should you be struck down?'" In other words, rephrase this for us in modern.
Shut up
or die. You don't stop talking, I'm going to kill you. I didn't give you permission to speak to the king. I didn't appoint you a royal counselor. You're not one of my cabinet members. So the prophet stopped. But he said, "I know that God has determined to destroy you because you have done this and have not listened to my counsel." So there Amaziah's fall begins, because it's where his pride begins. He starts to get confident in his own abilities. He thinks his 300,000 men are what saved him. He thinks the other gods are going to save him. And he's going to continue on the rest of his career. Now, this all happens right about the middle of his career, a little bit afterwards. He rules 25 years. This is probably around 15 years into his kingdom. So you can turn back to 2 Kings, and we'll pick up with the narrative there. 2 Kings verse 8. I'm sorry, 2 Kings chapter 14, verse 8. And it says, "Then Amaziah sent messengers to Jehoash, the son of Jehoaz, son of Jehu, king of Israel, saying, 'Come, let us look one another in the face.'" What does that mean? You're a handsome guy, and I want to see you again, right? No? What does it mean, look each other in the face? It's a duel. Exactly. Let's face each other off. Let's have a fight. Generally a good idea to announce you're coming in battle? Not usually, but that was kind of the idea. It's not just an attack. I'm not just trying to subdue you. I want to have a contest. And instead of us playing chess or even having a boxing match or having a duel to the death between our champions, we're going to have this contest, and I want you to come and bring your best guys. So I'm going to announce. I'm inviting you to a duel, is a good wording for it. So let's see how Jehoash responds to this. He's got a great way of responding. Verse 8 or verse 9. And Jehoash, king of Israel, sent word to Amaziah, king of Judah, a thistle on Lebanon sent to a cedar on Lebanon, saying, give your daughter to my son for a wife. And a wild beast of Lebanon passed by and trampled down the thistle. So if that answer came back to you, Daniel, you sent off to Timmy and you said, come, let's face each other like men. And Timmy sends back and says, you know, the thistle said to the cedar, give me your daughter for a wife. And then the bear came by and trampled the thistle. You would say, what? Because of what? What does that even mean? Okay, so which one's taller, thistles or cedars? Cedars, especially when you're talking cedars of Lebanon, they are big trees. So they're big. So the thistle is small. So the thistle's looking up at this big cedar and saying, give me your daughter for wife. What is that requesting? What is it assuming, maybe we should say? Not even necessarily an allyship or peace. What's that? No. Do you ask to marry? Think about ancient world, by the way. This is not quite so true in America, but do really important, powerful people marry peasants? Not often. Why not? Because it's not your station in life, right? You are lower because you are lower. You know, in America, we have valued hard work, and so in our country, it is a lot more based upon if you work hard, you can advance yourself and your station in life. In most other countries, that does not exist. Wherever you're born, that's your station in life, and you just better stay put. So the idea here is you're a thistle. What do to thistles? You step on them. You rip them out because they're annoying. What do you do to cedar trees? You use them to build your closets and things, right? Because they're really good. But the idea is the thistle is trying to cross through this boundary between stations of life. You are exalted in your pride. You're thinking of yourself more than you should. You are run away with your imagination of how great you are. And so the bear is going to come and trample you, meaning it's going to be your downfall. Solomon puts it this way in the Proverbs, pride goes before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall. And that's what's going to happen to Amaziah here. But how much time we got? Real quick here, let's finish out this section. So, his answer there in verse 10, you have indeed struck down Edom, and your heart has lifted you up. Be content with your glory and stay home. For why should you provoke trouble so that you fall, you and Judah with you? What kind of a response is this to a challenge to a duel? Insulting. It's insulting. I would wipe the floor with you so easy, Buster. You might as well just stay home or you're going to get it. It is an insulting response. It is a response to the challenge that says, I'm not even going to give you my attention because you're so worthless. It's an interesting response from a nation who just a few years ago only had 10,000 men in its army, now facing off to a nation that has 300,000 in its army. But, verse 11, Amaziah would not listen. So Jehoash, king of Israel, went up. He and Amaziah, king of Judah, faced one another in battle at Beth Shemesh, which belongs to Judah. And because numbers don't matter when God is involved, what happens? The smaller guy wins, right. And he doesn't just win, he wipes the floor with Judah. Verse 12, Judah was defeated by Israel, and every man fled to his home. So how much did that army mean now? Zero, zitch, zilch, zip, nothing, nada. Doesn't mean anything. God instilled in them a spirit of fear. They all fled, and they go home. So Jehoash, king of Israel, captured Amaziah, king of Judah. It's not bad enough you're going to be defeated in battle, but you're also going to get caught. And the son of at Beth Shemesh, and he came to Jerusalem. He broke down the wall of Jerusalem for 400 cubits from the Ephraim gate to the corner gate. This is on the side of Jerusalem facing the north. That's why it's called the Ephraim gate. It faces north towards Ephraim. It is the most accessible side of Jerusalem. On the south and on the west, you have the Kidron Valley, and you have a very difficult approach to Jerusalem. But on the northern side, it's kind of flat, and you actually descend into Jerusalem from the north. So he's removing the wall at the most vulnerable place of the city. This is an act that really leaves the city open to attack. So he tears down those 400 cubits. Verse 14, he seized all the gold and silver and all the vessels that were found in the house of the Lord and in the treasuries of the king's house. Also hostages, and he returned to Samaria. So how did this boastful challenge go for King Amaziah? Very badly. Don't be deceived. God is not mocked. Whatever a man sows, he will also reap. God has a way of returning our sin to us. He's bringing discipline to Amaziah so that he would be humbled from his pride. Verse 15, now the rest of the acts of Jehoash and all that he did. Now, who are we talking about? Now we're talking about the winner, the king of the north, right? Now the rest of the acts of Jehoash that he did and his might and how he fought with Amaziah, king of Judah, are they not written in the books of the Chronicles of the kings of Israel? And Jehoash slept with his fathers and was buried in Samaria with the kings of Israel, and Jeroboam his son reigned in his place. Amaziah, the son of Joash, king of Judah, lived 15 years after the death of Joash, son of Jehoaz, king of Israel. So at the very least, he doesn't have to endure the taunting from his kingly neighbor to the north. Hey, you remember that time I kicked your butt, wiped the floor with you in battle? Wasn't that funny? But King Joash dies, and so Amaziah reigns for 15 more years. Now the rest of the deeds of Amaziah, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Judah? Here's an interesting part. How did his dad die? He was assassinated. Look at verse 19. They made a conspiracy against him in Jerusalem, and he fled to Lachish. But they sent after him to Lachish and put him to death there. And they brought him on horses, and he was buried in Jerusalem with his fathers in the city of David. And all the people of Judah took Azariah, who was 16 years old, and made him king instead of his father, Amaziah. And we'll read about Azariah later. Another name for Azariah, you might be interested to know, is Uzziah. Does that name strike a bell? What's that? Wrong name, okay? If you're really familiar with your prophets, you'll recognize this from a very prominent passage in Isaiah 6 in the year that King Uzziah died. I saw the Lord high and lifted up. Right, this is the passage where Isaiah is taken to the throne room in heaven, and God says, whom will I send? That's the year King Uzziah dies. Now, Uzziah has a very long life. He rules for 52 years, but we're getting closer. And that just gives us a little bit of a perspective here on where we're coming into, because we are now in the age of the writing prophets. We talked a little bit about Jonah. Jonah's book was most likely written right during the time when these two kings are going to battle together, when Amaziah challenges Joash to a battle. That's right about the same time that Jonah is running off to Nineveh to preach his message. It's also very close to the time when another prophet named Joel is going to be writing a very short but potent book against the rebellious Israelites. So we have left the age of the speaking prophets with Elisha when he died, and we've entered the age of the writing prophets. It's a very different time in Israel, but God is still speaking to his people. He is still telling them to come back to faithfulness to the covenant. Amaziah started well, but he didn't finish well because he let pride trip him up. Any questions about anything that we've gone over today? All right, let's go ahead and close in prayer then.